sign of the dogs. Walking the outer perimeter of the fence, the patrolman clapped his hands and shouted, in case the animals were hiding under Curly's trailer or snoozing in the shade of the bulldozing equipment. "Boo!" yelled Officer Delinko. "Yo, Fido!" Nothing. He picked up a 2x4 and clanged it against a metal fence post. Again, nothing. Officer Delinko returned to the gate and checked the padlock, which was secure. He tried whistling, and this time he got an unexpected response.
"Coo, coo, coo, coo."
Definitely not a Rottweiler. The policeman saw something move inside the enclosure, and he strained to see what it was. At first, he thought it was a rabbit, because of its sandy brown coloring, but then it suddenly lifted off the ground and swooped from one corner of the property to another, finally landing on the cowling of a bulldozer. Officer Delinko smiled. It was one of those stubborn little burrowing owls that Curly had complained about. But where were the guard dogs? The patrolman stepped back and scratched his chin. Tomorrow he'd stop by the trailer and ask the foreman what was going on. As a warm breeze swept in, Officer Delinko noticed something fluttering at the top of the fence. It looked like a streamer from one of the survey stakes, but it wasn't. It was a ragged strip of green cloth. The policeman wondered if somebody had gotten their shirt snagged on the wire mesh while climbing over the fence. Officer Delinko stood on his tiptoes and retrieved the torn piece of fabric, which he carefully placed in one of his pockets. Then he got into his squad car and headed down East Oriole.
"Faster!" shouted Beatrice Leap.
"I can't," Roy panted as he ran behind her. Beatrice was pedaling the bicycle she'd taken from the rack at Trace Middle. Mullet Fingers was slumped across the handlebars, barely conscious. He had become dizzy and fallen from the fence as they were hurrying to leave the construction site. Roy could see that the boy was getting sicker from the infected dog bites. He needed a doctor right away.
"He won't go," Beatrice had declared. "Then we've got to tell his mother."
"No way!" And off she'd ridden. Now Roy was trying to keep her in sight. He didn't know where Beatrice was taking her stepbrother, and he had a feeling she didn't know either.
"How's he doing?" Roy called out.
"Not good." Roy heard a car and turned his head to look. Coming up behind them, barely 2 blocks away, was a police cruiser. Automatically, Roy stopped in his tracks and began waving his arms. All he could think about was getting Mullet Fingers to the hospital as soon as possible.
"What are you doing?"
Beatrice Leap yelled at him. Roy heard a clatter as the bicycle hit the pavement. He turned to see Beatrice bolting away, her stepbrother slung like a sack of oats over one shoulder. Without glancing back, she cut between 2 houses at the end of the block and disappeared. Roy stood rooted in the center of the road. He had an important decision to make, and quickly. From one direction came the police car. Running in the other direction were his 2 friends. Well, the closest thing to friends that he had in Coconut Cove. Roy drew a deep breath and dashed after them. He heard a honk, but he kept going, hoping that the police officer wouldn't jump out and chase him on foot. Roy didn't think he'd done anything wrong, but he wondered if he could get in trouble for helping Mullet Fingers, a fugitive from the school system. The kid was only trying to take care of some owls. How could that possibly be a crime, Roy thought. 5 minutes later, he found Beatrice Leap resting under a shady mahogany tree in a stranger's backyard. Her stepbrother's head was cradled on her lap, his eyelids half shut, and his forehead glistening. The deep bite wounds on his swollen arm were exposed, for the bandage had been pulled off, along with a sleeve of his green t-shirt, when he had toppled from the fence. Beatrice stroked the boy's cheeks and sadly looked up at Roy.
"What are we going to do now, cowgirl?"
Curly was done fooling around with attack dogs, and while he wasn't thrilled about spending nights at the trailer, it was the only surefire way to stop the delinquents, or whoever was sabotaging the construction site, from jumping the fence and going wild. If something were to happen over the weekend that resulted in another delay of the Mother Paula's project, Curly would be fired as foreman. Chuck Muckle had been crystal clear about that. When Curly told his wife of his overnight guard duties, she received the news with no trace of annoyance or concern. Her mother was in town visiting, and the two of them had planned numerous shopping excursions for Saturday and Sunday. Curly's charming presence would not be missed. Sullenly, he packed a travel kit with his toothbrush, dental floss, razor, shaving cream, and a jumbo bottle of aspirin. He folded some clean work clothes and underwear into a carry bag and grabbed a pillow off his side of the bed. On his way out the door, his wife handed him two fat tuna sandwiches, one for dinner and one for breakfast. "You be careful out there, Leroy," she said.
"Yeah, sure."
Upon returning to the construction site, Curly locked the gate behind him and high-stepped to the safety of the trailer. All afternoon, he'd been fretting about those elusive cottonmouth moccasins, wondering why the reptile wrangler hadn't been able to find them. How could so many snakes disappear all at once? Curly was afraid that the moccasins were lurking nearby in some secret subterranean den, waiting for darkness before they slithered out to begin their deadly hunt.
"I'll be ready for 'em," Curly said aloud, in the hope of convincing himself.
Bolting the trailer door, he sat down in front of the portable television and turned on ESPN. The Devil Rays were playing the Orioles later in the evening, and Curly was looking forward to the ball game. For the time being, he was perfectly content to watch a soccer match being played in Quito, Ecuador, wherever that was. He sat back and loosened his belt to accommodate the bulge in his waistband from the .38 caliber revolver he'd brought along for protection. He hadn't actually fired a gun since he'd been in the Marines, which was 31 years ago, but he kept a pistol hidden at the house and remained confident of his abilities. Anyway, how hard could it be to hit a big fat snake? Just as Curly was polishing off his first tuna sandwich, a commercial for Mother Paula's All-American Pancake House came on the television. There, dressed up as kindly old Mother Paula herself, was none other than Kimberly Lou Dixon, the former Miss America runner-up. She was flipping flapjacks over a hot griddle and singing some sort of goofy song. Although the makeup artist had done a darn good job, Curly could still tell that the old lady in the commercial was actually a much younger woman, and that she was pretty. Remembering what Chuck Muckle had told him about Kimberly Lou Dixon's new movie deal, Curly tried to picture her as the queen of the mutant grasshoppers. Undoubtedly, the special effects department would give her six green legs and a pair of antennae, which Curly found intriguing to contemplate. He wondered if he would be introduced personally to Kimberly Lou Dixon when she came to Coconut Cove to attend the groundbreaking ceremony for the new pancake house. The possibility wasn't so far-fetched, him being the supervising engineer of the project, the top guy in charge. Curly had never met a movie star or a television actress, or a Miss America, or a Miss Anything. Was it okay to ask for an autograph? He wondered. Would she mind posing with him for a picture? And would she speak to him in her phony Mother Paula's voice, or as Kimberly Lou Dixon? These were the questions knocking around inside Curly's head as the image on the TV screen dissolved to electric fuzz before his disbelieving eyes. Heatedly, he banged a mayonnaise-smeared fist on the side of the television console, to no avail. The cable had gone out in the middle of a Mother Paula's commercial. Not a good omen, Curly thought sourly. He used many bad words to curse his rotten luck. It had been years since he'd gone a whole night without television, and he wasn't sure how else to amuse himself. There was no radio in the trailer, and the only reading material was a construction industry journal with boring articles about hurricane-resistant roof sheathing and anti-termite treatments for plywood. Curly considered a quick trip to the mini-mart to rent some videos, but that would require crossing the property to reach his truck. With dusk approaching, he couldn't get up the nerve to venture outside, not with those deadly cottonmouths skulking around. He bunched the pillow under his head and tilted his chair back against the thin paneled wall. Alone in the silence, he wondered if it was possible for a snake to worm its way into the trailer. He remembered hearing a story about a boa constrictor that had crawled through the plumbing and popped out of a bathtub drain in a New York City apartment. Imagining that scene, Curly felt his stomach knot. He got up and padded cautiously to the entrance of the trailer's small bathroom. Placing one ear to the door, he listened. Was it his imagination, or did he hear a rustle on the other side? Curly drew the gun from his belt and cocked the trigger. Yes, now he was certain. Something was moving. The instant Curly kicked open the door, he realized there was no poisonous snake in the bathroom, no cause for mortal alarm. Unfortunately, the message didn't travel fast enough from his brain to his trigger finger. The boom from the gun startled Curly almost as badly as it had startled the field mouse that was sitting on the tile floor, minding its own business. As the bullet whizzed over its tiny whiskered head, shattering the toilet seat, the mouse took off, a squeaking gray blur that scooted out the doorway between Curly's feet. His hand trembling, Curly lowered the pistol and stared ruefully at what he'd done. He'd accidentally shot the commode. It was going to be a long weekend. Mr. Eberhardt was in the den, reading at his desk, when Mrs. Eberhardt came to the door with a worried expression.
"That policeman's here," she said.
"What policeman?"
"The one who brought Roy home the other night. You'd better come talk to him."
Officer Delinko stood in the living room, holding his hat in his hands. "Nice to see you again," he said to Roy's father.
"Is something wrong?"
"It's about Roy," Mrs. Eberhardt cut in.
"Possibly," said Officer Delinko. "I'm not certain."
"Let's all sit down," suggested Mr. Eberhardt. He was trained to remain calm while sorting through loose snippets of information.
"Tell us what happened," he said.
"Where is Roy? Is he home?"
the policeman inquired.
"No, he went to a friend's house to work on a science project," Mrs. Eberhardt said.
"The reason I ask," Officer Delinko said, "is that I spotted a couple of kids on East Oriole a little bit ago. One of them looks sort of like your son. The weird thing was, first he waved at the police car, and then all of a sudden he ran away."
Mr. Eberhardt frowned. "Ran away? That doesn't sound like Roy."
"Certainly not," Mrs. Eberhardt agreed.
"Why would he do that?"
"The kids left a bike lying in the street."
"Well, it's not Roy's. His bike has a flat," Roy's mother announced.
"Yes, I remember," the policeman said. "We had to order a new tire," Mr. Eberhardt added.
Officer Delinko nodded patiently.
"I know it's not Roy's bicycle. This one was stolen from Trace Middle School earlier this afternoon, shortly after classes let out."
"You're sure?" Mr. Eberhardt asked.
"Yes, sir. I found out when I radioed in the serial number."
The room fell silent. Roy's mother looked gravely at Roy's father, then fixed her gaze upon the policeman.
"My son is no thief," she said firmly.
"I'm not making any accusations," said Officer Delinko. "The boy who was running away looked like Roy, but I can't say for sure.
I'm only checking with you folks because you're his parents and, well, this is part of my job."
The policeman turned to Roy's father for support.
"Being in law enforcement, Mr. Eberhardt, I'm sure you understand."
"I do," Roy's father mumbled distractedly.
"How many kids did you see on the road?"
"At least two, possibly three."
"And they all took off?"
"Yes, sir." Officer Delinko was trying to be as professional as possible. Perhaps someday he would apply to become an FBI agent, and Mr. Eberhardt could put in a good word for him.
"And how many bicycles?" Mr. Eberhardt was asking.
"Just one. It's in the car if you want to take a look."
Roy's parents followed the policeman out to the driveway, where he opened the Crown Victoria's trunk.
"See?"
Officer Delinko motioned toward the stolen bicycle, which was a blue beach cruiser model.
"I don't recognize it," said Mr. Eberhardt.
"How about you, Lizzie?"
Roy's mother swallowed hard. It looked like the same bike ridden by Roy's new friend, Beatrice, when she'd accompanied him home from school.
Before Mrs. Eberhardt could collect her thoughts, Officer Delinko said,
"Oh, I almost forgot. How about this?"
He reached into a pocket and took out what appeared to be a torn-off shirt sleeve.
"You found that with the bicycle?" Mr. Eberhardt asked.
"Nearby."
Officer Delinko was fudging a little bit. The construction site actually was several blocks from where he'd spotted the kids.
"Does it look familiar?" he asked the Eberharts, holding up the ragged strip of fabric.
"Not to me," Roy's father replied.
"Lizzie?"
Mrs. Eberhardt appeared relieved.
"Well, it's definitely not Roy's," she informed Officer Delinko. "He doesn't own any green clothes."
"What color shirt was the boy wearing when he ran off?" Mr. Eberhardt asked.
"I couldn't tell," the patrolman admitted. "He was too far away."
They heard the phone ring, and Roy's mother hurried inside to answer it.
Officer Delinko leaned closer to Roy's father and said,
"I apologize for bothering you folks with this.
Like you were saying, it's all part of the job," Mr. Eberhardt remained polite, even though he knew the policeman wasn't telling him everything about the green rag.
"Speaking of jobs," Officer Delenko said, "you remember the other night when I brought Roy home with his flat tire?"
"Of course. In all that nasty weather?"
"Yes, I remember," said Mr. Eberhardt impatiently.
"Did he happen to mention anything about you writing up a letter for me?"
"What kind of letter?"
"To our police chief," Officer Delenko said.
"No biggie. Just a note for the permanent file, saying you folks appreciated me helping out your boy. Something along those lines."
"And this note should be sent to the chief?"
"Or to the captain. Even my sergeant would be okay."
"Roy didn't ask you?"
"Not that I recall," said Mr. Eberhardt.
"Well, you know how kids are. He probably forgot."
"What's your sergeant's name? I'll see what I can do."
Roy's father made no effort to conceal his lack of enthusiasm. He was running out of tolerance for the pushy young cop.
"Thanks a million," Officer Delenko said, pumping Mr. Eberhardt's hand. "Every little bit helps when you're trying to get ahead. And something like this, coming from a federal agent such as yourself."
But he didn't get the chance to give his sergeant's name to Mr. Eberhardt, for at that very moment, Mrs. Eberhardt burst out the front door, carrying a purse in one hand and a jangling set of car keys in the other.
"Lizzie, what's the matter?" Mr. Eberhardt called out. "Who was that on the phone?"
"The emergency room," she cried breathlessly. "Roy's been hurt."
12. Roy was exhausted. It seemed like 100 years ago that Dana Matherson had tried to strangle him inside the janitor's closet, but it had happened only that afternoon.
"Thanks, now we're even," Beatrice Leap said.
"Maybe," said Roy.
They were waiting in the emergency room at the Coconut Cove Medical Center, which was more of a large clinic than a hospital. It was here they'd brought Beatrice's stepbrother after carrying him upright for almost a mile, each of them bracing one of his shoulders.
"He's going to be all right," Roy said. For a moment, he thought Beatrice was about to cry. He reached over and squeezed her hand, which was noticeably larger than his own.
"He's a tough little cockroach," Beatrice said with a sniffle. "He'll be okay."
A woman dressed in baby blue scrubs and wearing a stethoscope approached them. She introduced herself as Dr. Gonzalez.
"Tell me exactly what happened to Roy," she said.
Beatrice and the real Roy exchanged anxious glances. Her stepbrother had forbidden them from giving his name to the hospital for fear that his mother would be notified. The boy got so agitated that Roy hadn't argued. When the emergency room clerk asked Beatrice for her stepbrother's name, address, and phone number, Roy impulsively had stepped forward and blurted his own. It had seemed like the quickest way to get mullet fingers into a hospital bed. Roy knew he was also getting himself in trouble. Beatrice Leap knew it too. That's why she had thanked him.
"My brother got bit by a dog," she told Dr. Gonzalez.
"Several," Roy added.
"What kind of dogs?"
the doctor asked.
"Big ones."
"How did it happen?"
Here, Roy let Beatrice take over the story, as she was more experienced at fibbing to adults.
"They nailed him at soccer practice," she said. "He came running home all chewed up, so we brought him here as fast as we could."
"Hmm," said Dr. Gonzalez with a slight frown.
"What? Don't you believe me?"
Beatrice's indignation sounded genuine. Roy was impressed. But the doctor was a cool one, too.
"Oh, I believe your stepbrother was attacked by dogs," she said. "I just don't believe it happened today."
Beatrice stiffened. Roy knew he had to come up with something fast.
"The wounds on his arm aren't fresh," Dr. Gonzalez explained. "Judging by how far the infection has progressed, I'd estimate he was bitten 18 to 24 hours ago."
Beatrice looked flustered. Roy didn't wait for her to recover.
"Yeah, 18 hours. That sounds about right," he said to the doctor.
"I don't understand."
"See, he passed out right after he got bit," Roy said. "It wasn't until the next day he finally woke up, and that's when he came running home. Then Beatrice called me and asked if I'd help get him to the hospital."
Dr. Gonzalez fixed Roy with a stern gaze, though there was an edge of amusement in her voice.
"What's your name, son?"
Roy gulped. She'd caught him off guard.
"Tex?"
he answered weakly. Beatrice nudged him with her elbow as if to say, "That's the best you can do?"
The doctor crossed her arms. So, Tex, let's get this straight. Your friend Roy is mauled at the soccer field by several huge dogs. Nobody tries to help him, and he remains unconscious all night and most of the next day. All of a sudden, he wakes up and jogs home. Is that right?
Yep.
Roy bowed his head. He was a pathetic liar, and he knew it. Dr. Gonzalez turned her steely attention to Beatrice. Why was it left for you to bring your stepbrother here? Where are your parents?
Working,
Beatrice replied. Didn't you call and tell them there was a medical emergency?
They crew on a crab boat. No phone.
Not bad, Roy thought. The doctor, however, wasn't buying it. It's hard to understand, she said to Beatrice, how your stepbrother could go missing for so long and nobody in the family got concerned enough to call the police.
Sometimes he runs away from home, Beatrice said quietly, and he doesn't come back for a while.
It was the closest thing to a true answer that she'd given, and, ironically, it was the one that made Dr. Gonzalez back off.
I'm going to check on Roy now, she told them. In the meantime, you two might want to polish up your story.
How's he doing anyway? Beatrice asked.
Better. He got a tetanus shot, and now we're loading him with antibiotics and pain medication. It's strong stuff, so he's pretty sleepy.
Can we see him?
Not right now.
As soon as the doctor had gone, Roy and Beatrice hurried outside, where it was safer to talk. Roy sat down on the steps of the emergency room. Beatrice remained standing.
This isn't going to work, cowgirl, once they figure out he's not you.
It's a problem, Roy agreed, the understatement of the year.
And if Lana hears about this, you know he'll end up in juvie detention, Beatrice said gloomily. Until she finds a new military school? Probably someplace far off, like Guam, where he can't run away.
Roy didn't understand how a mother could kick her own child out of her life, but he knew such tragic things occurred. He'd heard of fathers who acted the same way. It was depressing to think about.
We'll come up with something, he promised Beatrice.
Know what, Tex? You're okay. She pinched his cheek and went bounding down the steps.
Hey, where are you going? He called after her.
Fix dinner for my dad? I do it every night.
You're kidding, right? You're not really leaving me here alone.
Sorry, Beatrice said. Dad'll freak if I don't show up. He can't make toast without burning off his fingertips.
Couldn't Lana cook his dinner this one time?
Nope, she tends bar at the Elks Lodge. Beatrice gave Roy a brisk little wave.
I'll be back as soon as I can. Don't let him operate or nothing on my brother.
Wait! Roy jumped to his feet.
Tell me his real name.
It's the least you can do, after everything that's happened.
Sorry, cowgirl, but I can't. I made him a blood promise a long time ago.
Please?
If he wants you to know, Beatrice said, he'll tell you himself.
Then she ran off, her footsteps fading into the night. Roy trudged back into the emergency room. He knew his mother would be getting worried, so he asked the desk clerk if he could borrow the phone. It rang half a dozen times on the other end before the Eberhardt's answering machine picked up. Roy left a message saying he'd be home as soon as he and Beatrice finished cleaning up the mess from the science project. Alone in the waiting area, Roy dug through a stack of magazines until he found an issue of Outdoor Life that had an article about fishing for cutthroat trout in the Rocky Mountains. The best thing about the story was the photographs. Anglers wading knee-deep in blue western rivers lined with tall cottonwoods, rows of snowy mountain crags visible in the distance. Roy was feeling pretty homesick for Montana when he heard the approach of a siren outside. He decided it was an excellent time to go find a Coke machine, even though he only had 2 dimes in his pocket. The truth was, Roy didn't want to be in the emergency room to see what the siren was all about. He wasn't prepared to see them wheel in somebody who'd been injured in a serious wreck, somebody who might even be dying. Other kids could be really curious about that gory stuff, but not Roy. Once, when he was 7 years old and his family lived near Milwaukee, a drunken hunter drove a snowmobile full speed into an old birch tree. The accident happened only 100 yards from a slope where Roy and his father were sledding. Mr. Eberhardt had run up the hill to try to help, with Roy huffing close behind. When they reached the tree, they realized there was nothing they could do. The dead man was soaked with blood and twisted at odd angles.
like a broken G.I. Joe doll. Roy knew he would never forget what he saw, and he never wanted to see anything like it again. Consequently, he had no intention of hanging around the emergency room for the arrival of a new emergency. He slipped through a side door and wandered through the hospital for about 15 minutes until a nurse intercepted him.
"I think I'm lost," Roy said, doing his best to appear confused.
"You most definitely are." The nurse steered him down a back corridor to the emergency room, where Roy was relieved to find no chaos or carnage. The place was as quiet as he'd left it. Puzzled, Roy went to the window and checked outside. There was no ambulance in the delivery zone, only a Coconut Cove police cruiser. Maybe it was nothing, he thought, and returned to his magazine. Soon afterward, Roy heard voices from behind the double doors that led to the area where Mullet Fingers was being treated. A loud discussion was taking place in the patient ward, and Roy strained to make out what was being said. One voice in particular rose above the rest, and Roy was distressed to recognize it. He sat there in nervous misery, trying to decide what to do next. Then he heard another familiar voice, and he knew there was only one choice. He walked to the double doors and pushed them open.
"Hey, Mom!
Dad!" he shouted.
"I'm right here!"
Officer Delinko had insisted on giving the Eberharts a ride to the hospital. It was the decent thing to do, and also a prime opportunity to score points with Roy's father. The patrolman hoped that Mr. Eberhart's son wasn't involved in the continuing mischief at the Pancake House construction site. What a sticky situation that would be. On the drive to the hospital, Roy's parents sat in the back seat and spoke quietly between themselves. His mother said she couldn't imagine how Roy had got bitten by a dog while working on a science project.
"Maybe it had something to do with all that hamburger meat," she speculated.
"Hamburger?" said Roy's father. "What kind of school project uses hamburger?" In the rearview mirror, Officer Delinko could see Mr. Eberhart put an arm around his wife's shoulders. Her eyes were moist, and she was biting her lower lip. Mr. Eberhart appeared as tightly wound as a clock spring. When they got to the emergency room, the desk clerk declared that Roy was sleeping and couldn't be disturbed. The Eberharts tried to reason with him, but the clerk wouldn't budge. "We're his parents," Mr. Eberhart said evenly, "and we intend to see him right away."
"Sir, don't make me call a supervisor."
"I don't care if you call the Wizard of Oz," said Mr. Eberhart. "We're going in." The clerk trailed them through the swinging double doors.
"You can't do this,"
he objected, scooting ahead of the Eberharts and blocking the hallway to the patient ward. Officer Delinko edged forward, assuming that the sight of a police uniform would soften the fellow's attitude. He was mistaken.
"Absolutely no visitors. It says right here on the doctor's notes."
The clerk solemnly waved a clipboard.
"I'm afraid you'll have to go back to the waiting room. That means you too, officer."
Officer Delinko shrank away, not the Eberharts.
"Listen, that's our son lying in there," Roy's mother reminded the clerk. "You called us, remember? You told us to come."
"Yes, and you may see Roy as soon as the doctor says it's allowed."
"Then page the doctor. Now." Mr. Eberhart's tone of voice remained level, but the volume had gotten much louder. "Pick up the phone and dial. If you've forgotten how, we'll be happy to show you."
"The doctor's on a break. She'll be back in 25 minutes,
the clerk said tersely.
"Then she can find us right here," Mr. Eberhart said, "visiting our injured son. Now, if you don't move out of the way, I'm going to dropkick you all the way to Chokoloski. Understand?"
The clerk went pale.
"I'm reporting you to my supervisor."
"That's a dandy idea." Mr. Eberhart brushed past and started down the hall, guiding his wife by the elbow.
"Hold it right there,"
snapped a firm female voice behind them. The Eberharts stopped and turned. Emerging from a door marked Staff Only was a woman wearing baby blue scrubs and a stethoscope.
"I'm Dr. Gonzalez. Where do you think you're going?"
"To see our son," replied Mrs. Eberhart.
"I tried to stop them," the desk clerk piped up.
"You're Roy's parents?"
the doctor asked the Eberharts.
"We are."
Roy's father noticed Dr. Gonzalez eyeing them with an odd curiosity.
"Pardon me if this is out of line," she said, "but you sure don't look like you work on a crab boat."
"What on earth are you talking about?" Roy's mother said. "Is everybody at this hospital a total wacko?"
"There must be some mistake,"
Officer Delenko interjected. Mr. Eberhardt is a federal law enforcement agent.
Dr. Gonzalez sighed.
We'll sort this out later. Come on, let's go peek in on your boy.
The emergency patient ward had 6 beds, 5 of which were unoccupied. The 6th bed had a white privacy curtain drawn around it.
We've got him on IV antibiotics, and he's doing pretty well,
Dr. Gonzalez said in a low voice.
But unless we find those dogs, he'll need a series of rabies injections. Those are no fun.
The Eberharts locked arms as they approached the enclosed bed. Officer Delenko stood behind them, wondering what color shirt Roy would be wearing. In the patrolman's pocket was the bright green scrap of clothing that had snagged on the Mother Paula's fence.
Don't be surprised if he's sleeping, the doctor whispered, gently pulling the curtain away.
Nobody said a word for several moments. The 4 grown-ups just stood there, blank-faced, staring at the empty bed. From a metal rig hung a plastic bag of ginger-colored fluid, the intravenous tube disconnected and dangling to the floor. Finally, Mrs. Eberhardt gasped,
"Where's Roy?"
Dr. Gonzalez's arms flapped helplessly.
I don't know.
You don't know? Mr. Eberhardt erupted. 1 minute an injured boy is asleep in this bed, and the next minute he's vanished? Officer Delenko stepped between Mr. Eberhardt and the doctor. The patrolman was afraid that Roy's father was upset enough to do something he might later regret.
Where is our son?
Mrs. Eberhardt demanded again. The doctor buzzed for a nurse and frantically started searching the emergency ward.
But he was the only patient here,
Mr. Eberhardt said angrily.
How can you possibly lose the one and only patient you've got? What happened? Did aliens beam him up to their spaceship while you were on your coffee break? Roy! Roy, where are you?
Cried Mrs. Eberhardt. She and Dr. Gonzalez began checking beneath the other 5 beds in the ward. Officer Delenko whipped out his portable radio and said,
I'm calling for backup.
Just then the double doors to the waiting room flew open.
Mom? Dad? I'm right here.
The Eberharts practically smothered their son with a tandem hug.
Little devil, chuckled Officer Delenko, holstering his radio.
He was pleased to see that Roy wasn't wearing a torn green t-shirt.
Whoa!
Dr. Gonzalez clapped her hands sharply.
Everybody, hold on a minute.
The Eberharts looked up quizzically. The doctor didn't seem especially overjoyed to have found her lost patient.
That's Roy?
She asked, pointing at their son.
Of course it is. Who else would it be?
Mrs. Eberhardt kissed the top of his head.
Honey, you get back into that hospital bed right now.
Not so fast, Mr. Eberhardt said. I'm not sure what's going on here, but I've got a feeling we owe the doctor an apology. Probably several apologies. He planted both hands on Roy's shoulders. Let's see those dog bites, partner. Roy lowered his eyes.
I didn't get bit, Dad. It wasn't me.
Mrs. Eberhardt groaned.
Okay, now I get it. I'm the crazy one, right? I'm the raving loony bird.
Folks, excuse me, but we've still got a major problem, Dr. Gonzalez said. We've still got a patient missing.
Officer Delenko was thoroughly confused. Once again, he reached for his radio in anticipation of calling headquarters.
Before my brain explodes, said Mrs. Eberhardt, would someone please explain what this is all about?
Only one person can do that. Mr. Eberhardt gestured toward Roy, who suddenly wanted to crawl down a hole and hide. His father turned him around to face Dr. Gonzalez.
Tex?
She said, arching an eyebrow. Roy felt his face redden.
I'm really sorry. This is a hospital. This is no place for games.
I know it's not. I apologize.
If you're the real Roy,
the doctor said,
then who was that young man in the bed? And where did he go? I want the truth.
Roy stared at the top of his sneakers. He couldn't remember another day in his life when so many things had gone so wrong. Son, his father said, answer the doctor. His mother squeezed his arm.
Come on, honey. It's important.
You can be sure we'll find him, Officer Delenko chimed in. Sooner or later. Bleakly, Roy looked up to address the grown-ups.
I don't know the boy's name, and I don't know where he is, he said.
I'm sorry, but that's the truth.
And technically, it was.
13.
While Roy took a shower, his mother made a pot of spaghetti. He ate 3 helpings, though the dinner gathering was as quiet as a chess match. Setting down his fork, Roy turned to his father.
I guess it's the den, huh?
That's correct.
It had been years since Roy had gotten a spanking, and he doubted that he was in for one now.
The den was where his father summoned him whenever there was serious explaining to be done. Tonight, Roy was so tired that he wasn't sure if anything he had to say would make sense. His father was waiting, seated behind the broad walnut desk.
What have you got there? He asked Roy.
A book?
Yes, I can see it's a book. I was hoping for the particulars.
Roy's father could be sarcastic when he thought he wasn't getting a full answer. Roy figured it came from years of interrogating shifty characters, gangsters or spies, or whoever it was that his father was in the business of investigating.
I'm assuming, he said to Roy, that the book will cast some light on tonight's strange events.
Roy handed it across the desk.
You and Mom got it for me 2 Christmases ago.
I remember, his father said, scanning the cover.
The Sibley Guide to Birds.
Sure it wasn't for your birthday?
I'm sure, Dad.
Roy had put the book on his Christmas list after it had settled a friendly wager between him and his father. One afternoon, they'd seen a large reddish-brown raptor swoop down and snatch a ground squirrel off a cattle range in the Gallatin River Valley. Roy's father had bet him a milkshake that the bird was a young bald eagle whose crown feathers hadn't yet turned white, but Roy had said it was a fully grown golden eagle, more common on the dry prairies. Later, after visiting the Bozeman Library and consulting Sibley, Roy's father conceded that Roy had been right. Mr. Eberhardt held up the book and asked, "What does this have to do with that nonsense at the hospital?"
"Check out page 278, Roy said. "I marked it for you."
His father flipped the book open to that page.
"Burrowing owl," he read aloud from the text. "Athene cunicularia. Long-legged and short-tailed, with relatively long, narrow wings and flat head. Only small owl likely to be seen perched in the open daylight."
His father peered quizzically at him over the top of the book.
"Is this connected to that science project you were supposedly working on this afternoon?"
"There is no science project," Roy admitted.
"And the hamburger meat your mother gave you?"
"A snack for the owls."
"Continue," Mr. Eberhardt said.
"It's a long story, Dad."
"I've got nothing but time."
"All right," Roy said. In some ways, he thought wearily, a spanking might be easier.
"See, there's this boy," he began, "about the same age as me."
Roy told his father everything. Well, almost everything. He didn't mention that the snakes distributed by Beatrice Leap's stepbrother were highly poisonous and that the boy had actually taped their mouths shut. Such details might have alarmed Mr. Eberhardt more than the petty acts of vandalism. Roy also chose not to reveal that Beatrice had nicknamed her stepbrother Mullet Fingers, just in case Roy's father felt legally obligated to report it to the police or file it away in some government computer bank. Otherwise, Roy told what he knew about the running boy. His father listened without interruption.
"Dad, he's really not a bad kid," Roy said when he finished. "All he's trying to do is save the owls."
Mr. Eberhardt remained silent for a few moments. He reopened the Sibley Guide and looked at the color drawings of the small birds.
"See? If the Mother Paula's people bulldoze that property, they'll bury all the dens," Roy said.
His father put the book aside and looked at Roy fondly, though with a trace of sadness.
"Roy, they own the property. They can do pretty much whatever they please.
But they've probably got all the necessary paperwork and permits."
"They've got permits to bury owls?" Roy asked in disbelief.
"The owls will fly away. They'll find new dens somewhere else."
"What if they've got babies? How will the baby birds fly away?" Roy shot back angrily.
"How, Dad?"
"I don't know," his father admitted.
"How would you and Mom like it," Roy pressed on, "if a bunch of strangers showed up one day with bulldozers to flatten this house, and all they had to say was, 'Don't worry, Mr. and Mrs. Eberhardt, it's no big deal.
Just pack up and move to another place. How would you feel about that?
Roy's father stood up slowly, as if the weight of 100 bricks were on his shoulders.
Let's go for a walk, he said.
It was a calm, cloudless night, and a pale sliver of moon peeked over the rooftops. Insects as thick as confetti swirled around the cowls of the streetlights. Toward the end of the block, two cats could be heard yowling at each other. Roy's father walked with his chin slightly downward, his hands stuffed in his pockets.
You're growing up fast, he remarked, catching Roy by surprise.
Dad, I'm the third shortest kid in my homeroom.
That's not what I meant.
As they went along, Roy hopped from crack to crack on the sidewalk. They talked about comfortable topics, school, sports, sports in school, until Roy nudged the conversation back toward the delicate subject of mullet fingers. He needed to know where his father stood.
You remember that day last summer we floated the Madison Canyon?
Sure, said his father, in inner tubes.
Right, Roy said. And remember we counted 5 great horned owls in 1 cottonwood? 5.
Yes, I remember.
And you tried to take a picture, but the camera fell in the river?
Not exactly. I dropped it in the river, Roy's father recalled sheepishly.
Hey, it was a cheapo disposable.
Yeah, but it would have been a great snapshot. 5 in the same tree.
Yeah, said Roy. That was pretty amazing.
The owl story did the trick. His father took the cue.
This boy you told me about, you really don't know his name.
He won't tell me. Neither will Beatrice, Roy said. That's the honest truth.
He didn't take the stepfather's last name?
Leap?
No, not according to Beatrice.
And you say he doesn't attend school.
Roy's spirits fell. It sounded as if his father intended to report mullet fingers for truancy.
What worries me, Mr. Eberhardt said, is the family situation. It doesn't sound too good.
No, it's not, Roy conceded. That's why he doesn't live at home anymore.
Aren't there any relatives who can take care of him?
He feels safe where he is, Roy said.
Are you sure about that?
Dad, please don't turn him in, please.
How can I, if I don't even know where to find him?
Roy's father gave him a wink.
But I'll tell you what I am going to do. I'm going to spend some time thinking seriously about all this.
You should too.
Okay, said Roy. How could he possibly think of anything else? Even his battle with Dana Matherson seemed like a fuzzy, long-ago dream.
We better head home, his father said. It's getting late, and you've had a long day.
A real long day, Roy agreed. But after he got into bed, he couldn't fall asleep. His body was exhausted, but his mind was wide awake, buzzing with the day's turbulence. He decided to do some reading, and he reached for a book titled A Land Remembered, which he'd checked out from school. It was the story of a family who lived in Florida back in the 1850s, when it was still a wilderness. Humans were scarce, and the swamps and woods teemed with wildlife. Probably a pretty good time to be a burrowing owl, Roy mused. An hour later, he was half-dozing when he heard a tap-tap on the bedroom door. It was his mother, slipping in to say goodnight. She took the book from his hands and turned off the lamp on the nightstand. Then she sat down on the bed and asked how he was feeling.
Beat, Roy said.
Gently, she snugged the covers up to his neck. Even though he was way too warm, Roy didn't object. It was a mom thing. She couldn't help herself.
Honey, she said, you know how much we love you.
Uh-oh, Roy thought. Here it comes.
But what you did at the hospital tonight, letting that other boy use your name to get in the emergency ward?
It was my idea, Mom, not his. And I'm sure your heart was in the right place, she said. But it was still a lie, technically speaking, providing false information or whatever.
It's a serious matter, honey.
I know.
And it's just, well, your father and I don't want to see you get in trouble, even for the sake of a friend.
Roy raised himself up on one elbow. He would have run away before he'd given out his real name, and I couldn't let that happen. He was sick. He needed to see a doctor.
I understand. Believe me, I do.
They were asking him all kinds of nosy questions, Mom. And meanwhile, he's about to keel over from the fever, Roy said. Maybe what I did was wrong, but I'd do it all over again if I had to. I mean it. Roy expected a mild rebuke, but his mother only smiled. Smoothing the blanket with both hands, she said, Honey, sometimes you're going to be faced with situations where the line isn't clear between what's right and what's wrong. Your heart will tell you to do one thing, and your brain will tell you to do something different. In the end, all that's left is to look at both sides and go with your best judgment. Well, thought Roy, that's sort of what I did. This boy, his mother said, why wouldn't he give out his real name? And why did he run away from the hospital like that? Mullet Fingers had escaped through an open window in the women's restroom, next door to the X-ray department. He left his torn green shirt dangling from the antenna of Officer David Delinko's patrol car, which was parked outside the emergency room. He probably ran, Roy said, because he was afraid somebody would call his mom. So? So she doesn't want him anymore. She'll have him locked up at the juvenile hall. What? His mom sent him off to military school, Roy explained. And now she doesn't want him back. She said so herself, in front of Beatrice. Roy's mother cocked her head, as if she wasn't sure that she'd heard him correctly. His mom doesn't want him? Roy saw something flash in her eyes. He wasn't certain if it was sorrow or anger, or both. She doesn't want him? His mother repeated. Roy nodded somberly. Oh, my, she said. The words came out so softly that Roy was startled. He heard pain in his mother's voice, and he felt bad for telling her that part of Mullet Finger's story. I'm sorry, Mom, Roy said. I love you. I love you too, honey. She kissed his cheek and tucked in the sheets one more time. As she was shutting his door, he saw her hesitate and turned back to look at him. We're proud of you, Roy. You need to know that. Your father and I are both extremely proud. Did Dad tell you about the owls? Yes, he told me. It's too bad. What should I do? What do you mean? Nothing, Roy said, sinking into his pillow. Good night, Mom. She'd already answered the question anyway. All he had to do was settle the argument between his heart and his brain. 14. Luckily, the next day was Saturday, so Roy didn't have to get up early to catch the school bus. As he sat down for breakfast, the phone rang. It was Garrett. He'd never before called Roy, but now he wanted him to go skateboarding at the outlet mall. I don't have a skateboard, remember? Roy said. That's okay. I got an extra. No thanks. I can't make it today. The true reason that Garrett had called was, of course, to find out what had happened to Dana Matherson at Trace Middle. Dude, somebody tied him to a flagpole. Wasn't me, said Roy. On this topic, he couldn't talk freely in front of his parents. Then who and how? Garrett demanded. No comment, said Roy, echoing Mullet Fingers. Aw, come on, Eberhard. See you Monday. After breakfast, his father drove him to the bicycle shop to pick up his new tire, and by noon, Roy was fully mobile again. An address for L.B. Leap was listed in the phone book, and Roy had no difficulty locating the house. It was on West Oriole Avenue, the same street as the bus stop where he'd first spotted the running boy. In the Leap driveway sat a dented old Suburban and a shiny new Camaro convertible. Roy leaned his bike against the mailbox post and hurried up the sidewalk. He heard voices bickering inside the house, and he hoped it was only a TV show with the volume turned up. After three firm knocks, the door swung open, and there stood Leon Leap, all 6'9" of him. He wore baggy red gym shorts and a sleeveless mesh jersey that exposed a pale, kettle-sized belly. Leon looked as if he hadn't spent 5 minutes in the exercise room since retiring from pro basketball. All that remained of his NBA physique was his height. Roy tilted back on his heels in order to see Leon's face. His expression was perturbed and preoccupied. Beatrice home? Roy asked. Yeah, but she's kind of busy right now.
Only take a minute, Roy said. It's about school.
Oh, school,
said Leon, as if he'd forgotten where his daughter went 5 days a week. With a curious grunt, he lumbered off. A moment later, Beatrice appeared. She looked stressed.
Can I come in? Roy asked.
No, she whispered. It's a bad time.
Then can you come out?
Nuh-uh. Beatrice glanced anxiously behind her.
You heard what happened at the hospital?
She nodded.
Sorry I didn't get back in time to help.
Is your brother okay? Roy asked.
Better than he was, said Beatrice.
Who's there? Who is that? Demanded a chilly voice from the hallway.
Just a friend.
A boy?
Yeah, a boy,
Beatrice said, rolling her eyes for Roy's benefit. A woman not much taller than Beatrice materialized in the doorway behind her. She had a sharp nose, beady, suspicious eyes, and a wild fountain of curly auburn hair. Blue smoke curled from a cigarette poised in glittering fingertips. It could only be Lana, the mother of mullet fingers.
Who are you? She asked.
My name's Roy.
What do you want, Roy?
Lana took a noisy drag off the cigarette.
It's about school, Beatrice said.
Yeah, well, it's Saturday, said Lana. Roy gave it a try.
I'm really sorry to bother you, Mrs. Leap. Beatrice and I are doing a science project together.
Not today, you're not. Lana cut him off. Ms. Beatrice here will be busy cleaning the house.
And the kitchen.
And the bathrooms.
And anything else I can think of.
Roy believed Lana was skating on thin ice. Beatrice was obviously the stronger of the two, and she was seething mad. Lana might have softened her tone had she seen what her stepdaughter's teeth had done to Roy's bicycle tire.
Maybe tomorrow, Beatrice said to Roy, her jaw set grimly.
Sure, whatever. He backed down the steps.
We'll see about tomorrow.
Lana's voice was snide and croaky.
Next time, call first,
she grumped at Roy.
Ever heard of a telephone?
As Roy rode away on his bike, he pondered the possibility that Mullet Fingers was better off roaming the woods than living at home with a witch for a mother. Roy wondered what made a grown-up turn so ill-tempered and obnoxious. It wouldn't have surprised him if one day Beatrice literally chewed Lana's head off. His next stop was Dana Matherson's house, where another shaky example of motherhood lived. Roy had a feeling that Dana's father was no prize either, and it was he who answered the door. Roy had expected another Neanderthal hulk, but Mr. Matherson was thin and jittery and unhealthy-looking.
Hi, my name is Roy.
Sorry, we're not interested,
Dana's father said politely, and began to shut the door.
But I'm not selling anything, Roy said through the crack. I'm here to see Dana.
Uh-oh, not again.
Mr. Matherson reopened the door and lowered his voice.
Let me guess, he's hired you to do his homework for him.
No, sir, I'm just a friend from school.
A friend?
Dana didn't have many friends, Roy knew, and the few he had were all much larger and meaner looking than Roy. I ride the bus with him, Roy said, and decided to recycle Beatrice's line one more time. We're doing a science project together. Mr. Matherson's brow furrowed.
Is this some kind of joke? Who are you, really?
I told you.
Dana's father took out his wallet.
All right, young man. No more kidding around. How much do I owe you?
For what?
For my son's homework.
Mr. Matherson held up a $5 bill.
The usual?
He looked defeated and ashamed. Roy felt sorry for him. Clearly it was an ordeal raising a goon like Dana.
You don't owe me a dime, Roy said. Is he home?
Mr. Matherson asked Roy to wait at the door. Moments later, Dana appeared, wearing droopy boxer shorts and a grimy pair of sweat socks.
You, he snarled.
Yep, said Roy. It's me.
What are you staring at, cowgirl?
Not much, Roy thought. He noticed that Dana's lisp had disappeared, along with the swelling in his upper lip.
You must be nuts to ride all the way over here, Dana said, just so you can get stomped to a pulp.
Come on outside. I haven't got all day.
What did you say?
Dana stepped onto the porch and shut the door behind him.
presumably so that his father wouldn't be a witness to the bloodshed. He wound up and swung fiercely at Roy's head.